You're listening to the Global Capital Podcast, proudly sponsored by KFW.
Hello and welcome to the Global Capital Podcast. I'm Ralph Sinclair and I'm the London Bureau Chief at Global Capital, and my usual co-host John Hay, who is our Corporate Markets and Sustainability Editor, is away this week. But I am delighted to be joined by our Deputy Bank Finance Editor, Sarah Ainsworth. Welcome. I think this is your first time on the podcast, isn't it?
Hey Ralph, yes, that's right. Thank you very much for inviting me. Excited to be here.
Marvellous. Look forward to having you. And rejoining for the first time in what feels like yonks is our SSA reporter Georgie Lee. Good morning.
Hiya. Hi Ralph. Morning. Excited to be here.
Excellent. And a more familiar face who might now be rather less excited to be here is our senior emerging markets reporter George Collard. Good morning, George.
Morning. Yeah, thanks for having me on again.
I notice you don't confirm whether or not you're more or less excited to be here than usual, yeah. But never mind.
No comment.
We'll start with a story you've written this week, Georgie, about the gilt market, UK government bonds. The UK government embarks on its annual gilt funding remit as of next month. Its financial year, of course, starts in April. First of all, tell us how much it has to issue and how that compares to recent years.
So last week the DMO announced its remit for the coming financial year, which starts in April, so for 2024-2025. The UK Debt Management Office plans to carry out £265 billion in gilt sales, which is up £28 billion versus last year. And it's going to be doing that. It's kind of reduced by about £4 billion its long conventional gilt sales, and it's increased by £14 billion its mediums, and increased by about £8.7 billion its short dated issues. It's had a bit of a shift, kind of sparked by some feedback that it received from its gilt edge market makers at the start of the year, and also gilt investors about the sort of what the average duration should be of its issuance, basically.
Well, that is interesting, because one of the UK's trump cards, as it were, as a sovereign issuer, has been its ability to issue such long dated debt. Why is it that has now changed and they're having to sort of issue shorter? Because also another thing is we've seen like a lot more duration this year in the market, haven't we? We've seen a lot more issuance of long dated bonds as investors try and sort of capture yields before rates fall. So what's going on?
Yeah, so the thing that's changed, and it's not necessarily a brand new thing. As I said, it was sort of flagged at the start of the year at this annual meeting that the DMO has with the gilt market. And it was basically kind of brought to their attention, although some people that I interviewed said that this has kind of been happening in the background for the last few years, is that demand from LDI investors and the UK pension fund industry in particular has been dropping off. And they obviously are by long dated and ultra long dated gilts and index linked bonds as well, to hedge their liabilities. So demand from this kind of core group of investors for the DMO is declining, and so that's why it was kind of recommended that the DMO slightly restructure its duration in the coming year.
Okay. Anyone who was around the bond market in 2022, which is not that long ago, will be familiar with the term LDI. Others may not, but that's liability-driven investments, isn't it? And that's it's particularly pertinent here because it includes pension funds, and the idea is that basically they are buying assets, long-dated assets, to match their long-dated liabilities, which is that they have to pay out pensions in 30, 40, 50 years' time. But why have they started buying fewer gilts, and why is that 2022 date significant?
Sure. So in autumn 2022, then Chancellor of the Exchequer Kwasi Kwarteng presented his budget, which kind of included lots of unfunded tax cuts, which kind of sent the gilt market gilt yield soaring. And this kind of translated into sort of chaos for pension funds who hold an awful lot of long-dated gilts. And there was basically a mass sell-off, which sent kind of prices falling even more. And the Bank of England basically had to step in to inject liquidity into the gilt market and stabilize the gilt market. So I think since then, what people have been saying is that a lot of these LDI investors had been sitting on the sidelines and not getting involved as much in long dated issues and linker issues. So there's that sort of echoing in the background. The other thing is that there's more of a kind of shift in pension, what's happening in the pensions industry in the UK, in terms of kind of reform, and also just where defined benefit pension schemes are closed to new members, so they're not growing anymore, so they don't have this need for long dated gilts. Also, schemes are maturing and schemes have also already de-risked, so there's not that sort of appetite for gilts that there once was.
I think you said in your article too, didn't you, that life expectancy is not increasing in the same way.
Yeah, that's another kind of grisly sort of statistic that was flagged in this consultation with the DMO as well, that life expectancy is decreasing in the UK. So that obviously also has an impact on demand.
Well, there's a cheery benefit for the obesity crisis. That's a wonderful news. So are other buyers going to step in to buy these long dated gilts? I mean, I presume not, if the DMO is planning to shift the balance of its issuance slightly shorter. What else might the DMO have to do to sort of maintain this level of level of buying?
Yeah, so I think the feeling is that the DMO can't just kind of click its fingers and a new set of buyers will appear for these long dated issues. As you say, it will need to reduce the duration of its issuance on average, and that will naturally, I'm told, bring in more sort of international interest anyway, because international buyers tend to buy, shorter dated gilts. It's not a natural fit for them to buy long dated and index linked. The other thing that the DMO might have to do, according to a couple of investors that I spoke to, is pay up a little bit in the new issues market by about a basis point or so, not more than that. I haven't heard, and that's to kind of entice people or make up for the fact that this core group of buyers are absent or will be absent from the market. One investor told me that he would expect to see that sort of coming into the DMO's books in future.
Yeah, it is interesting, isn't it? Because another of the UK's advantages beyond being able to issue such duration so cheaply and the reason it's been able to do so is because it's had almost this like captive audience of domestic investors, the UK pension funds in particular. I mean, there is no one else issuing sterling debt in that size at that sort of maturity at all. Okay, but how is that manifesting itself in gilt issuance now? Because the UK did a syndication this week, didn't it?
Yeah, so it did its last syndication of the 2023-2024 financial year, and it was a linker and it got record demand. So that's interesting to see. And there was still this strong bid actually from the LDI community. So this isn't something that's going to suddenly shift, and it's not going to be a sudden change. It's just something that is slated to happen over the next year and over the next few years, that demand is kind of gradually going to drop off from this group of buyers. But yeah, you wouldn't sort of know it from the DMOs. I think it got a 56 billion book on Wednesday.
Wow. Okay. Now, another thing going on in the UK is, like many countries, we've got an election coming up later in the year. We don't know when at the moment. But is there any sign of anxiety over that in the gilt market at all?
Yeah, so this was a potential election was flagged to me by dealers and investors as a sort of potential sort of risk factor or key event that that could have an impact on the gilt market. I think some people were more positive than others. One banker told me that in some ways there's less of a risk in the UK versus perhaps other countries, the US, Germany, France, in that there's already been this kind of transition, at least sort of in terms of the Treasury and kind of fiscal responsibility from Kwasi Kwarteng to Jeremy Hunt. And perhaps to some, that is viewed as a sort of more stabilizing force in the gilt market. But I think others say that, you know, if we do have an election soon, you know, that naturally carries with it risks. And if the Conservatives are, you know, down in the polls, that could increase the possibility of them sort of offering a fiscal giveaway ahead of the election, and that will obviously have implications for the budget and therefore the DMO.
Thank you, Georgie. Sarah, you and Atanas Dinov, our bank finance editor, have been writing for the last couple of weeks about how the shine appeared to be coming off of the financial institutions bond market. Is that still the case?
It isn't, no. We're back to, pick your own superlative, firing on all cylinders, frenzied. It's back to where we were a few weeks ago. Deals are landing at flat to fair value. Order books are huge. It feels like a couple of weeks ago there maybe was a bit of a blip. So the market didn't go weak. It just, we sort of went from like a 10 out of 10 to an 8 out of 10. Mm. And there was a sense, like some bankers were saying, just because the market had been so strong for so long, there was a sense people were saying, well, maybe we'll look back and say the market peaked in February. This week it seems that's not the case. And, and it's universal across credit, not just FIG, but corporates and, you know, dollars, euros, everything really. It's all back to being very strong.
Okay, well, give us a couple of examples then from the FIG market. I think you mentioned sort of deals from Virgin Money, Nordea and Barclays this week that are all sort of exemplars of this phenomenon.
So Virgin Money, they've been in the news nationwide with their acquisition of Virgin Money. And when that was announced, that created a lot of excitement. And with the spreads between the two banks, there was an expectation that those two spreads would converge. And there was a lot of interest in the market. And then they came out this week, Virgin Money, and with a euro senior deal. And the book size was $7.5 billion for a $750 million deal, which is huge. I think we looked up and I think it's the second largest order book since 2022 or something.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
We did have one, I think, in January, like a Commerzbank. They got maybe 8 yards. So 10 times subscribed, a crazy book for it, and it just shows that appetite is back.
I mean, we should mention as well that March 2022 deal was by JP Morgan, which is rather more a household name than Virgin Money, but outside the UK at least.
Mm-hmm, yeah, and it was $2.5 billion. So that was back in 2022. That was quite spectacular. Mm. What else did we have? Nordea came. They landed a senior non-preferred at 105 basis points, which is the tightest spread I think we've seen for a 7-year or longer maturity so far this year. Because that's been part of the backdrop as well. People just saying, given how tight spreads are now, how long can this keep going? But the fact that they landed it at such a tight price, they pay maybe negligible 1 or 2 basis points in premium. Bankers away, you know, I think one banker away from the deal said it was a trade they will never regret doing, because it's such a great level for them.
High praise indeed.
And then over in sterling, which has been that, you know, that's been another story that we've been writing about. The sterling fig market has been undersupplied this year compared to last year, despite structural demand for sterling bonds from some of the UK buyers. So Barclays came along. They sold £1 billion, which is the biggest sterling fig bond this year. And the market just ate it straight up. Again, a banker away from the deal said, you know, it was a great, great trade. They could have done more. The books closed at over £4 billion. So, yeah, and I mean, and there are more as well, you know, like in, and it, you know, it's all kind of names all across the credit stack, peripheral names as well, Italian banks. Everything is just, you know, once again going very, very strong.
Why is it all going so well? You know, I guess the market's been strong anyway this year, but what are the main drivers in the FIG market in particular at the moment as to why there's such clamour for these deals?
Yeah, so in the FIG market, it's actually, it's a supply issue as well as a demand issue. So I think demand has been universal across, you know, we've seen that in European corporates and all different credit classes. But specifically in the FIG market, what we've noticed is there has been a bit of a slowdown in the pace of supply in the past few weeks. And supply year to date is running at a slower pace than it was last year. So there are a few, that's in euros, so there are a few reasons for that. One thing that people have flagged is that the fact that Euro issuers and UK issuers are going into the Yankee market at the moment. So that's going into the US dollar market to get raise US dollar funds. A couple of reasons why. One is that the cross-currency arbitrage is attractive for them at certain parts of the curve. So it's nice of them, instead of raising money in euros, to go into dollars. And also, you know, dollars is just such a deep market. There's so much depth there. If you want to get, I mean, not that euros isn't, but in dollars especially. And it's just part of this theme globally about there's so much demand. I think I read like a fund, a quote somewhere saying that US money market funds have $8 trillion sitting in cash that they're trying to put to work. So there's this huge demand as well out there in dollars. So that's one reason on the supply side that it's some issuers going into the Yankee market, into the US dollar market.
Okay, what about the supply outlook then? Because there's also, like in a lot of markets, there's a lot of front loading of issuance this year, wasn't there? And another thing that's been going on, well, that we've known is coming for a long time, is repayment of cheap liquidity that banks took out from the ECB. Meaning that they will have to refinance that money in the capital markets, most likely. Well, at least that was the prediction. So what's the outlook for those two things, and how will that manifest itself in new issues?
Yeah, I think, I mean, like you said, there is that requirement, but actually what's happened is there has been front loading.
Definitely not front running. Absolutely.
Old habits die hard. No. Front loading from some of these issuers, like especially some of the French names. And they've communicated that, and that's because of the perceived election risk in the second half of the year and the volatility. So even though supply this year is running behind what it was last year, you know, many sort of issuers are actually ahead in their funding. And there's some other factors as well. I think, you know, another factor was like looking at the risk-weighted assets of banks, and there's a perception that they're unlikely to grow this year. And any new financing that banks do will be more, you know, just refinancing their some of their existing outstanding debt.
Tell us a little bit about that risk-weighted asset part, because that's sort of related to higher rates and the amount of lending banks are doing, isn't it? And that's kind of the driver behind why they're not needing to borrow more.
Higher interest rates are still being transmitted through to the banking channels, and this kind of subdued lending activity, and they're not, you know, there isn't the same loan demand as there was from like corporates and private individuals as there was before. And I think, you know, one DCM bank has said we're still sort of seeing that impact from higher rates feeding through into the real economy and into bank lending, and that in turn is perhaps maybe having, and it will have an impact when it comes to bank issuance as well, and yeah, the amount that is sold by banks this year.
Yeah, and we talked a little bit about demand then on the other side. I mean, there's still huge inflows, aren't there, from asset managers, like, to sort of buy all this issuance that isn't going to happen.
Yeah, that's been the real phenomenon this year. Well, people say that it sort of started the end of last year, but it's just continued through. We're into like something like 18 weeks or something of consecutive inflows into credit funds, and that's just huge, and there's been no sign of that slowing down substantially, really. So that is driving it across, you know, across big bonds, across covered bonds, corporates, and it's been quite remarkable this week where we've seen, you know, in some cases many deals pricing with a negative new issue premium. So people, you know, so for asset managers, because they have such size to do, it makes more, you know, to buy bonds, it makes more sense, it's more effective for them to go into the primary market and buy in bulk there, as opposed to, you know, trying to go into the secondary market. Normally, they would expect to be compensated with a spread for doing that in the new issue premium, for having to take the new supply and not go into the secondary market. But the opposite is often the case now. So huge, huge order books and negative, often negative new issue premiums. So could that become the new normal? Well, I don't know. As long as there's such huge inflows into credit and huge cash, which itself, you know, we could talk about separately, but it comes down to interest rates just being higher now, and there's so much more cash, sort of, you know, whether it's corporates or asset managers, private individuals, that needs to be invested, that needs to be put to work.
Okay, and you've written another article too. It's one of our leader articles this week, which I thought was very interesting. And you talk about how banks are actually issuing debt, and that they're basically going to issue either at the short end of the curve or the long end of the curve. And we sort of mentioned already about increased duration, so increased issuance of long-dated debt. What's driving both of those dynamics, or each of those dynamics? Because it's separate in each case, isn't it?
Yeah, so in the short end, I think I mentioned before about this one of the themes we've seen with all the asset manager demand is there's been a shift away from deposits and holding in cash towards money market and short dated duration credit funds, people just looking for a bit more of a pickup, and so some of that has been, for example, in euros we've seen a pickup in euro floating rate note issuance. We've seen more 2-year and 3-year issuance, and what's interesting is when you look at the allocations and the order books, there's been an increase in the proportion of asset managers buying those, as opposed to, say, bank treasury funds. And at that end of the market, yeah, the order books have really swelled. There's this huge appetite for yield at the front end of the curve, where there wasn't before, because when rates were negative, I mean, you know, people, there didn't seem such a point in doing it because it was negligible, the difference. But now people's behaviour has changed and they're ploughing money into these other funds where they can get a bit of credit pickup as well. The other end, we've got long end issuance, which has been, you know, that's probably been the bigger theme this year. Issuers going in the FIG sector further up the curve, going to 10 years. We've seen a few 10 years print this year, 12 years. So from the issuer's perspective, that makes sense, because one thing we saw last year was a lot of issuance concentrated in the belly around the 5 and the 7 year sector. And now they want to go slightly longer to extend their duration to better match their, for some of them, not every issuer, but to better match their asset liability management requirements that they have. So from the issuer's perspective, it makes sense. And then on the other side for investors, well, some of those, such as like insurers and asset managers, again, they're looking for duration themselves, and also to lock in yield while they can. This whole backstory of sort of rates, you know, rates have peaked and we'll lock in yields while we can. So that's kind of been the two, you know, two of the themes, that the two different parts of the curve, the short end and the longer end. And that's often manifested itself where we've seen when issuers have come and done dual tranches, they've often done like a 3-year and a 12-year leg, and they've gone really well. But what that has left is some investors saying, well, hold on, don't neglect the belly, because, you know, there are some investors who maybe don't have the mandate, they can't go out to 10-year, and they're not necessarily wanting to buy something in the short end either. But it comes down to, again, though, it's like an issuer's market at the moment, so that they can pick and choose what to do and when, because there's so much appetite, so much hunger for debt. But we're kind of saying, well, you know, just as sometimes when you're pricing a new premium, and you might leave pricing a new issue, and you might leave a few basis points of premium on the table to keep investors sweet. You know, don't forget investors as well that still have this hunger in the belly of the curve that want sort of bonds in the 5 to 7 year sector.
Yeah, so from an obesity crisis in the gilt market to empty bellies in fear.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever had quite such a sweeping range of nutrition on the podcast before. And I guess that means that, you know, I guess to your point, any issuer that did want to issue in the belly of the curve with an intermediate maturity would have it away. Like, I mean, like the sterling market, I guess, perhaps, which has been undersupplied, then they'll have even more sort of joy with a sort of 5 to 7 year deal, presumably, in terms of what they pay over their curves.
Yeah, but I mean, but then again, the thing is, like bankers said, well, it's an issuer's market, and some of them, because they have front loaded, and you know, the market may be really attractive, but some of them just don't have the requirements to print at the moment. So yeah, I mean, if someone did come and print in that segment, sure, it would be, you know, maybe like a negative premium or something, I don't know, but they'd get huge order books. But that's the case across the whole market at the moment. They can probably still get that if they go to 3 years or 12 years. So we'll have to wait and see. One banker did say that he thought we would get some more issuance in the belly in the next week or so. So yeah, that would be something interesting to watch.
All right, great. Well, we'll keep an eye out for it then. Thank you, Sarah. George, another credit market experiencing having a wonderful time. Emerging market bonds that you cover. There's been record volumes, record deals. Just fill us in on what's been happening this week as the sort of latest example of what's been going on.
It's been a record year so far for senior sovereign bonds, and the latest pretty spectacular deal this week was from Poland, which raised $8 billion in the dollar market, which was its own biggest ever fundraising in one day, but it was also the most raised in one day by any sovereign in Central and Eastern Europe, beating a record set by Russia over a decade ago. And it took volumes so far this year to $65 billion across the dollar and euro markets, which is miles ahead of any year before.
But what's interesting here is that there are still net outflows into the market from dedicated emerging market funds, aren't there?
Yeah. 2022 and 2023 were all pretty awful years, particularly 2022 for emerging market or dedicated emerging market bond funds, where money just flowed out continually. And if you combine the 2 years, it's well over $100 billion. And those inflows haven't returned really in any meaningful way. I think there's been there have been some inflows, but I mean, they're nothing compared to the outflows that have happened over the past 2 years.
So who's buying all this stuff?
Well, there's something that some people like to call tourist money, probably more politely called crossover investors, who are, I think they're mainly investment grade focused market investors who also are able to buy emerging market bonds as and when they want to. And they mostly will buy trades like Poland this week, which is an A-rated sovereign.
Yeah, it's not really an emerging market credit, is it, anymore?
No, it's I think the attraction is that it has the same credit ratings as countries in Western Europe, for example, but it trades a little wider. Essentially, because of its postcode, it's in Eastern Europe, it's in Central and Eastern Europe's case, and there are other sovereigns in emerging markets like this who are probably not emerging market sovereigns, but are just, yeah, in the wrong part of the world, in the eyes of investors. For example, Poland is geographically close to Ukraine compared with Western European sovereigns with similar ratings. So it in the bond market, it trades wider and it offers a little bit more for investors compared with those countries nearby, but in Western Europe.
Okay, and it's not just the Poland deal they've been buying either, is it? They've been coming in for other sort of more yieldy sovereign names.
They will come in, perhaps not in the proper high yielding sovereigns that you get in CEMEA, so sub-Saharan Africa, for example, or some of the other sub-investment grade sovereigns in Southern and Central and Eastern Europe in the Middle East. But yeah, they will come in as and when they see fit.
Okay, well, tourist money, I mean, that sounds like by definition that it doesn't stay around forever. What are the expectations for flows for the more dedicated funds? Are they ever going to come back? I mean, and what's that going to spell for issuance to come?
Yeah, I think the expectation is pretty positive from investors. And there's a pretty clear reason for that. And it's that the market, not just emerging market investors, they think the US Federal Reserve will start cutting rates later this year. That's priced in. It's widely expected and hoped for. And then how that plays into emerging market bonds is that in the last few Fed rate cutting cycles, pretty much as soon as they start, emerging market bond returns really rise and they start to outstrip equities, for example. And then there's this saying in the bond market that, or at least in emerging market bonds, that flows follow performance. So essentially, once returns start looking really good, especially compared to developed markets or equities, clients who in the past few years have been put off from emerging markets because of all the negative headlines, because of inflation, all that sort of thing, they'll start to come back in, and that means inflows will come back in. So yeah, it's a positive outlook. So yeah, it is all predicated on the Fed cutting rates, whenever that might be, whether it's in June or later in the year. So if that doesn't happen, it'll be interesting to see what occurs. But yeah, I think investors are pretty confident.